Well, we have been walking up to the window this week or these weeks and seeing just this picture, this vision of a different reality, of a different world. And this is really what the Sermon on the Mount is. When Jesus preaches the Sermon on the Mount, it's like he's walking us up to a window where we see a very different reality, a different world that is so different than the world that we have our feet in. And we know that. We know the world that we have our feet in. It's what people call the real world. It's the way that things are. It's dog eat dog. It's you punch me, I'm going to punch you back, and I'm going to punch you harder than you punched me. And it's every man for himself and every woman for herself and all that kind of stuff. You know how the real world works. In preaching the Sermon on the Mount to us, Jesus walks us up to this window and says, okay, there's another way. There's another reality out there, and it's so very different from the one that you're living in. And so the Sermon on the Mount isn't just good moral advice to cope in this world. It really is a whole other reality. And then we look at the next slide, and we're reminded once again. I'm not going to read it every time, but I am going to remind you that it says right in the middle there, draws us to live in allegiance to the kingdom of heaven, however difficult, however costly, or however impractical it seems. I want to continue to remind you that there's so much in the Sermon on the Mount that seems difficult, costly, and impractical. And so much of the time when we encounter it in the Sermon on the Mount, you're tempted to say, oh, that's never going to work, or that's too costly, or that doesn't make sense, or that's not reasonable, or you know, you're tempted to look at what Jesus is saying in the Sermon on the Mount and to push back a little bit. And the reason why we're tempted to do that is because our feet are in that old world. And we need to be willing to see a different reality that is in the Sermon on the Mount and to not explain it away. Well, what Jesus really meant was, and he really didn't mean it like that. We tend to explain it away just to soften Jesus up a little bit. And I think the last thing Jesus wants from us is to soften him up. He said what he said, and so it's important for us to realize that. Then look at the next one with me, this timeline. Once again, the simplest way for me to describe what God is up to in the bigger scope of human history. In the beginning, that crown is right side up, relationships are right, God to humanity, relationships within humanity, everything is just the way it should be. No sin, no death, no disease, none of that stuff. Everything is whole and complete. Sin enters the picture, the crown gets turned upside down, everything gets turned upside down. Death is introduced, sin, disease, all that stuff. Relationships are severed. Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, everything just spirals down from there. When the crown turns sideways, that really represents Jesus' first coming. When Jesus came the first time, he began to, in his death and his resurrection, Jesus' death and resurrection changed things. We believe that, changed things. And that crown began to turn back right the right way. It began to turn, and it's still turning. Even to this day, it's still turning. And one day, we believe, and the last two chapters of the Bible tell us, that crown's going to be right side up again, and it's going to be back the way God wants it. No death, no disease. Relationships will be put back together. No sin, none of that stuff. The curse will be gone, it says in the book of Revelation. And so one day, that crown's going to be right side up again. We live in that purple shaded area as the crown is turning. We live between Jesus' comings. And our responsibility, our calling is to live right side up in an upside down world. So much of the world is upside down and it's broken by sin, and we see that. The evidence is all around us. We don't have to make that case, do we? We know it. We live in it. And this is the call as followers of Jesus, as disciples, and this is really what it means to be holy, is to live right side up by God's strength and empowerment. With his help, to live right side up in a world that is so utterly upside down. And so we can choose to live as the way everybody else lives and just go ahead and live upside down in the upside down world and say it's not worth it. Or we can choose to live differently. We can choose to live another way. And that's the way that we're called to be able to live. Well, let me recap what we talked about last week really quickly. The salt and the light. We talked about what salt meant. We talked about what light meant. But really, Jesus couples them. He puts them together. And so we ask the question, what do salt and light have in common? And because that's an important question to ask. And so we talked about how salt and light are both useful. It's about how they're used. And so we, as followers of Christ, are meant to be used for the kingdom. In both those examples of salt and light, they're not meant to be corrupted or concealed. And so we, as followers of Christ in this world, we're not to be corrupted or concealed in any way. One of the things that we said about salt and light, it's interesting. Salt and light are not about salt and light. Salt and light are about what they salt and what they shed light on. And so church, it's not about us, right? We're salt and light. Salt and light are not supposed to be about salt and light. And so we don't need to be making it about us, but it's about salting on and shedding light on the world. We talked last week about how salt and light both have a public purpose. You are the salt of the earth. You're not the salt of your living room. You are the light of the world. And so they have public purpose. And then lastly, salt and light are both meant to penetrate or to engage in the world. And we talked about how the crazy part of it all is the people who Jesus had assembled when he preached at the Sermon on the Mount were the peasants, the underclasses, the undesirables in that culture. And the craziest part about that whole thing was Jesus said, "You are the salt of the earth and you are the light of the world." And people went away that day going, "Us? Really? You want to change the world with us?" And so last week, that's what we did. We all walked out going, "Us, really?" And Jesus says, "Yeah, people like you." And so he takes people like us to do his work in this world. We talked last week about how this is a revolution. The world is turning. Jesus is refusing to accept the world the way it is. That's what the Sermon on the Mount is. Jesus is refusing to accept the world the way it is. That's the whole reason he preaches the Sermon on the Mount. It's like Jesus is saying, "I am here to fundamentally change the world, and I'm going to do it with people like you." He's refusing the sin-sick status quo, right? We see that in the Beatitudes. The world says all this stuff is great and privilege and status and all that, but I tell you that it's really the poor in spirit, the persecuted, the meek. These are the ones who are blessed in this world. We see it with salt and light. Jesus is refusing to accept the world the way it is, so he calls us to be salt and light in the world. So this is really is a revolution taking place, but it's a revolution of a different sort. They expected revolutions leading up to Jesus' day and throughout Jesus' day. They expected revolutions, and there were some attempts at revolutions, but they were all Rome's way. They were taking up arms and swords and spears and that kind of stuff, and they got squashed by Rome every single time. Jesus' revolution is the most powerful, most successful revolution in human history, and it happened without taking up any arms whatsoever. It's a revolution of a different sort, a revolution that doesn't play by Rome's rules, doesn't play by the rules of the world. It was a revolution, the kind of revolution that nobody was expecting. And so there's this sense that you're listening to the Sermon on the Mount, and you're beginning to hear, okay, things are changing. According to what Jesus is saying, things are changing. So everything's changing. And is everything changing? And what's not going to change? And so wheels are turning. And what about the law? Because in the mind of the Jewish people, that's the one thing that never needs to change, the law of God. So what about our Jewish heritage? What about our faith? Is that up for grabs? Is that, Jesus, are you coming to get rid of that stuff too? So there was this sense, it was present some in Jesus' day, but especially in Matthew's day, by the time that this was recorded, there was this sense, generations after Jesus, the faith community, just they kept struggling with what was Jesus' relationship to the law? What was Jesus' relationship to the Old Testament faith? How much of the law do we still need to follow if we're going to follow Jesus? The church struggled with this for decades and decades and decades after Jesus, basically asking the question, if we're going to be Christian, how Jewish do we need to be? And that might sound like a silly question to us 2,000 years later, but it's stuff they had to work through, right? That's stuff they had to work through. And a lot of Paul's writings kind of helped them work through this kind of stuff. And so this statement that we get to today, we're about to read it, Matthew 5, 17 to 20, if you want to start turning there. This statement is for those who in Jesus' day, they're trying to wrap their minds around what Jesus was saying and Jesus' relationship to the law. This statement is also for those in Matthew's day, when Matthew recorded it, trying to figure out how much of what we now call Old Testament, how much of the Old Testament law applies to them. And still even today, can we just go ahead and say that a lot of Christians today have a curious relationship with the Old Testament? There are a lot of Christians I know of who say, the Old Testament doesn't apply to us, just kind of dismiss it all. And so we just got the New Testament. That's really what matters. Some Christians will say that. Others say, well, it applies, but we're kind of confused on, well, what parts of the Old Testament apply to us and what parts of the Old Testament don't apply to us? And I think a whole lot of people are confused about that. And so, what a lot of people do is they just pick and choose the parts they like out of the Old Testament, right? Really, we do that with the whole Bible, don't we? Yeah. But specifically with the Old Testament, pick and choose. And I don't like tattoos. And so I'm going to go to that one obscure place in Exodus where it says something about that could be about tattoos. So I'm going to let that be about tattoos. And that's what people do. I wasn't speaking for myself there. I was in character. But I don't know too many people who don't like pork or shellfish, and those are prohibited in the Old Testament. Oh no, that doesn't apply. That doesn't apply because I really, really like pork chops or whatever, that kind of stuff. So what so many people do is we're confused about what parts of the Old Testament law apply to us, what parts don't. And so what a lot of us do, and hey, let's just be honest, we've been there, we know people who are there, just kind of pick the parts we like, right? And kind of leave the parts alone that we don't like and say that some applies to us and some doesn't. And so the looming question over this is, what is Jesus' relationship to what we call the Old Testament, the law of God? And in this passage, when Jesus says the law and the prophets, it's the whole scope of the scriptures of the Hebrew people that we've come to know as the Old Testament. So let's read what we got here in Matthew chapter 5, 17 to 20. Jesus says, and this is right after salt and light, right? Do not think that I've come to abolish the law or the prophets. I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I tell you, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished. Therefore, anyone who sets aside one of the least of these commandments and teaches others accordingly will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever practices and teaches these commands will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. Okay, let's start to try to figure out what Jesus is saying here. When the law is referred to, we're talking about the first five books of the Bible, the books of the law, the books of instruction. They're usually attributed to Moses. They're called the Pentateuch. Popularly, if we were to go and ask people in church or out of church, what is the law, and describe the law, and what does the law mean, and what is the law for? I think most people would describe it in terms of the rules, the thou shalls and the thou shalt nots, the 600. There were 619, just so you know, 619 clear cut binding demands from God for us. The I'm God and I said so rules, right? Because I said so, you'd better fall in line kind of rules. That's kind of the mindset that so many people have with the law, with God's law. But the truth is, for the Jewish people, the law was so much more than that. It was so much richer and deeper and fuller and more important than just that cartoon image we have of just the rule book, the because I said so kind of rules. And I want to get us to one passage that's just a piece that kind of begins to express a little bit of the mindset of how the Jewish people felt about the law, okay? Psalm 119 is the longest psalm, and it is the longest chapter in the whole Bible, okay? And as I read this, I want you to think about and pay attention to, have your radar up for how the psalmist feels about the law, okay? You ready for this? Here we go. Blessed are those whose ways are blameless, who walk according to the law of the Lord. I will praise you with an upright heart as I learn your righteous laws. I will obey your decrees. With my lips, I recount all the laws that come from your mouth. I meditate on your precepts and consider your ways. I delight in your decrees. I will not neglect your word. Open my eyes that I may see wonderful things in your law. I'm a stranger on earth. Do not hide your commands from me. Your statutes are my delight. They're my counselors. I will always obey your law forever and ever. I will walk about in freedom, for I've sought out your precepts, for I delight in your commands because I love them. I reach out for your commands, which I love, that I may meditate on your decrees. And it goes on and on and on and on from there. And I just lifted enough that would fit on the screen at one time to share with you. How does the psalmist feel about the law? Somebody tell me. What's your impression of that? Does that sound like the, because I said so, you better fall in line, kind of impersonal, throw the book at you, thou shalls, and, you know. Well, how does the psalmist feel about the law? Yep. It's delight, yeah. And a couple of times I think he uses that word. Anybody else? Rejoicing or joy is present over the law. Good. Anybody else?
He's happy to obey them.
Happy to obey.
Glad,
yeah. Yep.
He's more than willing to do what he has to do.
Folks, this is a love letter. Not to God, but to God's law. Psalm 119 is one big, long love letter to God's law. I love your law. I mean, head over heels, smitten. The psalmist is a goner for God's law. And that's what it is. I mean, I love your law. And so the relationship that the Jewish people had with the law is so much richer, fuller, deeper. It's a very personal relationship. It's so much more than just the impersonal because I said so, like, you know, all that mindset that people have about the law, the binding demands and all that kind of stuff. Okay, so just to get a big picture, and I know you think about the crowns and the graph that I showed you before, but just to kind of reiterate, in the beginning, creation, everything's right, sin enters the picture, and once sin enters the picture, once that crown is turned upside down, God goes on this massive rescue operation, right, to recover humanity. Adam and Eve sin, and what does God do? He comes after him, arms outstretched. He's looking to recover humanity. And all throughout the pages of Scripture, all throughout history, this God is reaching out for humanity, trying to recover us and restore us to what we were in the very first place. And that's really doesn't just happen in the garden in Genesis chapter 3, but that's really the whole scope of Scripture, what's happening and what's going on. The law of God, when we get to in the first few books of the Bible, the law of God, the law is an essential part of God's rescue operation. As God is seeking to recover humanity and to restore them in a right relationship to himself, the law is an essential part of that. Think about this. The people of God were slaves in Egypt. God delivered them through the Red Sea. Egyptian army's gone, and so he rescued them. He made them a people, And then he began to give them the law. That's when God met Moses on the mountain and the covenants established. And it's almost like God is saying, in giving the law to the people, I've saved you. I've rescued you. You're mine. Now here's the law. So this is how I want you to live like you're mine. Now, this is critical. This is one of the most important things that we need to understand about the Bible. God did not come to the people of Israel and say, while they were slaves in Egypt, here's the law. You obey my law, and I'll get you out of here. I'll get you out of Egyptian slavery. I'll get you across the Red Sea. I'll give you a land flowing with milk and honey. You obey my law first. It's not what God did. He rescued them first. And then he said, now that you're my people, this is how I want you to live like you're my people. And that's grace. That is what grace is. Grace and law are not opposites, but they function together and work together. And so the law is part of God's covenant relationship with the people, living in this covenant relationship with this God. And so the purpose of the law was to turn people away from their sinful state, to turn them back toward God. That's an essential part of this covenant that he makes with them. The law was God's instrument to call humanity back to him, to recover humanity. The law is God's way of saying to the people, come back to me. This is how I want you to live. I want you to live in wholeness and in righteousness, and I want you to live like you're my people. The law was for their good. It was for their good. Really, the law was an act of grace for them. Law is not the opposite of grace, but here's how I want you to live. Live in the right direction. Live away from sin. Live in this way. I've got another simple diagram for you. I'm a simple diagram guy. Here's God and humanity. They're together. Everything's right in the very beginning, and everything is whole, complete, the way it should be. And then what happens pretty quickly, if we look at the next one, is sin takes us away from God. I'm coming up here. Is it freezing? There we go. So that's what sin does. Sin kind of severs that relationship. Not only does it do that, but sin kind of separates humanity from humanity, right? So that's the work that sin does, and we don't have to work hard to make that case. So God and humanity are divided in this way, and then we see what happens next is that God gives them the law as an act of grace of saying, this is how I want you to come back to me. The law was for the purpose of orienting the people of God back to him. And so the law was a beautiful thing, an act of grace. And you notice the psalmist said, I need your law. It's my counselor. You get that sense that he needs that law to be able to know how to live in the right way back to God. So the purpose of the law was to orient the people back to God. And so the law was good. And then the prophets continued to speak to the people, to Israel, thus saith the Lord, to call them back, turn back, come back to God. So there's this massive work, come back to God, to right living, to right side up living. And you continue to hear that. So this is really what's happening throughout the pages of the story of God. And so the intent, the heart, the purpose of the law is to call them back to life, back to wholeness, back to relationship with God. The problem is that the law can only bring us really so far, right? The law can help orient, can help direct us back, and the law was a beautiful gift from God. But we see throughout the stories of the Old Testament, there were times when the people of God were oriented toward him. There were times when they turned away. There were, you know, it's like this seesaw type of effect. And so this is what's happening. And then when we get to the point of the New Testament, this is what God does. God in Christ comes to us to do what the law could not fully do, to bring us back to God, so that we can be in right relationship with him once again. So one of the things I want you to see in this diagram is that what what Jesus is doing is working in conjunction with the law, the same purpose as the law, to bring us back to wholeness, to bring us back into right relationship with God. By Jesus' day, the law had become somewhat legalistic, and Jesus points that out, you know, with the religious leaders in his day, 619 clear-cut binding demands, the Pharisees, the religious leaders, and all that. In many cases, it had become religion for the sake of religion that was void of any sense of covenant relationship. It was, as I mentioned a few weeks ago on a Sunday morning, it was a religion without the heart of God. And Sabbath keeping was a prime example of that, because there were several run-ins that Jesus had with the Pharisees about Sabbath. It was all about the religious practice, doing the right thing, but it was void of the heart of God. So the major question that are in people's minds, some in Jesus' day, definitely in Matthew's day, is, okay, what do we do with this Old Testament law? Do we keep following the Old Testament law? Do we keep it or do we cancel it, basically? Do we keep it? Do we cancel it? Do we keep it? Do we cancel it? What do we do, Jesus? Are we supposed to scrap it? Is it obsolete? Has the law run its course? Do we abolish it? Do we disregard it? Do we keep it or do we cancel it? You all know that anytime you go to Jesus with two options, he always picks the third one. Did you know that? Okay. So many times we limit a choice to two options, and that's when Jesus comes and says, no, it's the third option. It's the third option. Jesus refused to get locked into two options. With Jesus, there's often a third way, and that's what Jesus presents, the third way. It's like Jesus is saying, the law will not be kept as it has been, nor shall the law be canceled out. But Jesus says, I've come to fulfill the law. Another word is embody or complete or confirm the law. One of the things that we should always keep in mind is that Jesus never stopped being a faithful Jew. He practiced his entire life as a faithful Jew. He never stopped that. Jesus didn't come to start a new religion. He came to be the fulfillment of what was. And so he didn't come to do anything but be the fulfillment. And so what Jesus is saying, and what this diagram helps us see, is that Jesus is saying, I've come to complete what God has been doing all along. What Jesus is doing is consistent with what the law was doing, bringing people back to God. Jesus is saying, who I am is not in opposition to the law. I am the completion of the purpose of the law. That's what that is. Jesus himself is the completion of the purpose of the law. I have come to be what the law was supposed to be in the first place, to get us back into right relationship with God the Father. The law, Jesus might say, the law and I are not in opposition, but we are working toward the same end. And so we see that the purpose of the law for the people of God, even though the law among many Christians today gets a bad rap, the purpose of the law was good, and what Jesus did was to complete the work of the law. And that's important for us to recognize. Jesus has come to bring us back to God. He is what the law was supposed to be. At the end of this passage, Jesus says, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you're not going to enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, the Pharisees were the super righteous people. And Jesus isn't saying, I want you to try harder to be holier than they are. One up them. Be holier than the Pharisees. One up them when it comes to your spiritual life. But in fact, what Jesus is saying is the opposite. The Pharisees and the teachers of the law, their righteousness got them to where they are, but it really hasn't brought them far enough. It is the righteousness of Christ in us, empowered by his grace, that makes us righteous. None of us is righteous on our own, okay? None of us is righteous. It is Christ in us. It is his righteousness in us. It is him living in us. And it is that that makes us more righteous than the Pharisees, not because of us, again, right? But it is because Christ is in us. And that's what he's calling us to live. To live a spiritual life where Christ is in us, that surpasses what the Pharisees could live on their own strength according to the law, or that what we could live on our own strength. Let me see. I'm running out of time. Y'all are interrupting me too much. by Jesus' day, there was a major emphasis on what the law says and what the but we see that Jesus is less interested in what the law says, and he's more interested in what the law means. Okay? The heart, the intent, the purpose behind the law. Because the Ten Commandments, those 619 commands, the law of God is not some impersonal, because I said so kind of stuff, but there is real reason, purpose behind it. So I preached a few weeks ago, one of these encounters Jesus had about the healing on the Sabbath, and the law says don't work on the Sabbath. And so they were all following what the law says. And so by Jesus healing on the Sabbath, he was breaking that law, right? You know, in those days, they had to count their steps. They couldn't walk more than so many steps or they'd be breaking the law. Did you know that still today, if you go to Israel, some parts of the world, elevators on Sabbath, the buttons don't work. They're programmed to stop on every floor on the way up and on the way down because pushing a button is work. Okay, there are some parts of the world, Israel, other parts of the world you go to, where you might stay in a hotel or go to a public place. The toilet paper is already torn off the roll and placed on squares there for you to use because tearing toilet paper is work. Not kidding. That's real stuff. There's this sense of what does the law say? You got to follow what the law says. But Jesus comes and brings what the law means. The law's for life. It's for life. That we're not supposed to be slaves anymore. It's not about that back-breaking labor. You remember what I preached a few weeks ago. The law says or the law means. The so many people in Jesus' day were focused on what the law says. The law says that certain foods are unclean. Well, the law means be pure. Don't contaminate your life with that which is unholy. Doesn't mean you can't eat pork or you can't throw a football because it's made of pigskin. It really gets to the heart, the meaning, the purpose. There's a reason that was there in the first place. It's kind of like there was a law when I was a kid, don't play in the street, right? That was a law, don't play in the street. And a few weeks ago, I played in the street. Can you believe it? I didn't stand back and say, it's a law. The law says don't play in the street. I can't play in the street. But there was, the streets were blocked off. People were out. There was a thing going on. And so our family went out there. We were in the street. We were playing the street. And the law might say don't play in the street, but the law means regard and protect life and to take life seriously. So there's this sense of so many people, the Pharisees in particular, were so good at following what the law says. And Jesus is coming along to say, okay, let's talk about what the law means. Not just what it says, but what it means. Now, I'm going to be the first to say this work of getting to the meaning of the law is complicated. Figuring out these commands is complicated. It's messy, hard work. It's much easier to say the law says, right? And just follow the law for what it says. This is why we need the church to help us together, because the Spirit is in the church helping us together to figure out what does the law mean? What does the Scripture mean? How do we understand and interpret it? And nobody's left to ourselves to try to figure out a lot of this confusing stuff. One of the things that we should recognize is that when we look at the law, we look at the law through the lens of Jesus. So here we are, the church. And we don't just look at the law as it is, but Jesus is kind of our lens to view the law. So when we look at the law, we're looking at the law through the New Testament Jesus, and he becomes our lens for showing us, okay, what is the heart of the law? What is the intent of the law in how Jesus lived his life? We don't just look at the law by itself, detached from who Jesus was. And that's important for us to remember. Jesus helps us interpret and understand the law because of who he was and what he came to do. And so in this statement, Jesus is saying, I'm going to the heart of the law to show you how you can live out its deepest meaning and live in right relationship with God. Now, one of the things that you should understand, and I talked at the beginning about how all of these sessions kind of build on one another. This particular passage, "I've not come to abolish the law, but to fulfill the law," is a jumping off point for the next six statements that come. Because right after this, Jesus goes into some stuff that builds on this, okay? It really sets the tone, sets the pace for the next six things that he says. And in each of these, and it's important, as we look at the next six things over the next several weeks, it's important for us to remember what Jesus is talking about here. "I've come to complete the law, to continue the work of the law," and because it really builds on that. And it's like Jesus is saying, the law might get you so far, but grace-empowered living takes you even further than that. Because the six statements that Jesus is about to make after this, there's a formula to them that he uses six times, one after the other, after the other. "You have heard," then he says, "what the law says, but I tell you," and then he says what grace-empowered living is and how it takes us further in the same direction as the law. And it's important for us to recognize that. We're going to talk about that as we go through. In each of these cases, Jesus gets to what the law means and not just what the law says. It's like Jesus saying the law of God is good because it's brought you to this point, but what grace-empowered living does is it takes you further in the same direction as the law. It doesn't negate the law. It takes you further in the same direction as the law, toward God, toward righteousness, toward wholeness, toward upside-down living. And so all six of them do that. They build on this one. Let me just go ahead right now and give you one of my own. Jesus didn't say this, but he might as well have, okay? And I wasn't meaning to be funny there, but okay. So you have heard it said to tithe, but I tell you to give willingly, generously, big-hearted, open-handed, selflessly. Okay? Some people say that tithing is Old Testament stuff. It's the law. It doesn't apply to us. New Testament doesn't talk about it as much. We're under grace, so we don't have to tithe. It just kind of negates that. Well, that's the wrong kind of thinking, really, if you look at it, the way that Jesus operated. Because Jesus is saying, you've heard it said to tithe, but I tell you to give generously of what you have. So grace-empowered living carries us further in the same direction, which really means that if we're living under grace, we would be people who give more and not less. I wasn't expecting an amen there. But do you see, that's one example. You have heard it said to tithe, but I tell you to give generously. Grace-empowered living carries us further in the same direction. He does it six times in a row right now, okay? You have heard it said, Old Testament law, but I tell you, and it carries us even further. Grace-empowered living carries us further in the same direction as the law. So next week, we're going to have our week of renewal, so we're going to not do this. Maybe you need to catch your breath anyway. I understand. And then in the weeks that come after that, we're going to look at these six statements that really follow this formula. You've heard it said, but I tell you. You've heard it said what the law says, but I tell you, grace-empowered living carries you further in that same direction as the law. And Jesus is going to give us some stuff that are impossible for us to live on our own without his help. I mean, you've read ahead. You know what he's about to tell us, right? I mean, some pretty crazy stuff. Some stuff that we'd say it's impractical, it's impossible, it's not reasonable, it's not rational, you know, that kind of stuff. It is impossible for you to live in these ways without his grace, without his empowerment, without his transformation, without his spirit inside of you. And he means for it to be that way. And so it's important for us to recognize that. Really, when we get down to it, it is about this heart of God, this covenant relationship with God, this God who wants to recover us and restore us and wants us to live in wholeness and rightness. I said to you a few weeks ago, religion is good unless it interferes with the heart of God. In fact, the point of religion, the point of law in the first place, was to express the heart of God toward his people. And sometimes when we only emphasize the rules, the demands, the God says so kind of stuff, we tend to forget and lose sight of the heart of God. And a large part of what's happening, not just in this passage, but in the whole of the Sermon on the Mount, and then in the larger scriptures, the larger point is that we are called to be his people who live with his heart. And if we try to live the way he wants us to live with our own old hearts, we're going to fail miserably, and it's an impossible effort. But we're called to be people, his people, who live with his heart. And we're going to keep seeing that come up as we go. Lord, thank you.